Hi, you're watching Stefan Levera podcast brought to you by swan.com. Have you wondered about the role of design in Bitcoin applications? Well, today I've got some experts joining me, Christoph and Mogashni, who are joining me from the Bitcoin design community. And we talk about some various ideas like how design can create trust, how you can leverage design principles in your own Bitcoin products, as well as some of the Bitcoin-specific design challenges. I had an interesting chat, and I believe you'll get some value out of this also. On to my chat with Christoph and Mo. Christoph and Mogashni, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, Stefan.
Super happy to be here. Thank you.
Great. So I know you guys are part of the Bitcoin design community, so we're going to get into that. Let's just start with a little bit of a background on yourself. How did you guys get into doing this Bitcoin design stuff?
I would say ladies first.
Very kind of you, Christoph. Thank you. I somehow had this idea 3 years ago that I wanted to research two Bitcoin wallets, and I found myself into my way into the Bitcoin design community, and that's been the beginning of my journey, which seems to continue now.
And were you doing this kind of work, you know, outside of Bitcoin beforehand, or?
I've always been a researcher. I've always worked as a consultant in research. I've always been an entrepreneur, and so I decided to actually study front end development. I decided that me and code were not friends. And somewhere along the line, while studying front-end development, I came across this thing called UX design. And I was like, what is that? I've never come across that before. And then UX design was the perfect triangulation between psychology, design, and research. And it was those three passions that I've always had. And I was like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And always been passionate about freedom in itself as a concept. So Great. Freedom for money is something that definitely Great. Pulled me into the Bitcoin space.
And for you, Christoph?
Yeah, so I grew up with computers, but studied traditional graphic design and been now doing digital design for about 20 years now. Nice. Like 2017, a friend of mine, like I was kind of at a time in my career where I feel like, you know, I've done this for like 13 years. I feel like I've seen everything. And then a friend told me about Bitcoin and I kind of dug into it a little bit and I discovered this like whole new world. That's like this whole ecosystem, this whole culture, this whole way of doing this principle building. And I realized the power of this. And then I was working for a startup at the same time that was doing well. But I just thought there was just something really unique and special there, and I just couldn't let my hands off. So I decided like this is something really worth digging into. Like there's some new ground explored here. So then for about 2.5 years I helped out with the Monero GUI. It just kind of slipped into that on the side, and then now 4 years of full time open source Bitcoin design via the community and foundation now.
Great. Okay. So I think people will want to start with why, right? So why do all this design stuff? Why is it even important?
I mean, I can just tap into that story. So, you know, when I tried out the first wallet, I was like, you know, this is incredibly powerful technology here. Like if you really think about the role of money in the world, like everyone uses money. It is super meaningful. You work, you store your value in money, you use it every day. And if that can be made digital, natively digital, that is just more powerful than, you know, email messaging, like so many other things, right? And we need to get this right. And then I realized there was this open source aspect to it. And it really only works if it stays open source and incredibly neutral and all of this. And I've just seen it in my career so many times where you can have the greatest technology. You can have like RSS or email or, you know, other things, and they can kind of be captured by, you know, corporations and whatnot. So I feel like I really want to see Bitcoin succeed. And I think we need really great open source design ecosystem and really solid applications that work for a ton of people around the world for different use cases for that to actually be the case. So I enjoy design. I love designing, but I also see it as kind of essential for Bitcoin to kind of really fulfill its potential. So for me, it's like, I'm excited about this. I'm excited to help and chip in there.
Yeah. And Mogashni, anything to add there?
Good design creates trust. we need more trust in the applications that we build. We're building products where people are putting in their financial wealth. And if the trust is not there with using the application, then we can say goodbye to our users. And so good design creates trust. And it's not just about building pretty things. It's about building an interactive experience. So for me, it's about how can we build user interfaces that create more trust in the eyes of our users so that they keep on using our applications and that they tell their friends about it.
Yeah, and that's a really big hurdle. I talked to someone recently, someone from India, and he said, well, he doesn't trust Bitcoin because there's no government fallback, right? Which is like, okay, gets kind of the point, right? But, you know, we have these existing systems in society that people just kind of trust. And to trust cryptography, to trust that you can manage your keys, that you only do that if you really feel like you have great applications that, you know, like that take you along for the journey and help you do this thing right. Because like otherwise, you know, it's money. It's very risky.
I mean, I'm sure you can remember the first time you downloaded a Bitcoin wallet and how you felt and what sort of psychological process you had to go through before you made the decision like, I trust this wallet, I'm going to put my Bitcoin on there. And that's what good design does. It's building a relationship with the users of your application.
Yeah, that's interesting as well. I think people have often, you know, in this space, obviously there's been a lot of scams and a lot of people losing money. So there's a lot of paranoia and people are reluctant, let's say, to just try out new things. Or at least if they do, they'll, you know, maybe try it with a small amount, not, you know, put their whole stack on some, you know, random new wallet or things like that. And so that's, you know, people have relied on that idea of, let's say, trial by fire. Like this tool has been out there for 10 years or for 5 years and it's solid. And now I'm going to start to trust it a little bit more. And so let's bring it just to explain a little bit about where you guys are coming from, the Bitcoin design community. I know Spiral is funding some of the grants and some of the work here. Can you just explain a bit, just to give us an overview on what is the Bitcoin design community?
Yeah, I can start with the origin story, and then Mo, maybe you want to explain the current state a little bit. How about that?
Sure.
So the Spiral started as Square Crypto, they wanted to hire some engineers and they wanted to hire a designer to kind of create this task force to then figure out what they wanted to do. That I think that was before they decided to do LDK and BDK and the other various initiatives. And then they just interviewed a ton of different designers, and they realized there were these designers were out there, but they really worked in those silos, and they felt kind of, you know, like lonely by themselves, and they were all kind of reinventing the wheel. So they decided, you know, how about we just bring everyone together in this design community and create a space where design can happen, where they can together discuss these problems, you know, find good solutions that can be applied across the whole ecosystem, really learn from each other. And then ideally, there are all these positive effects that happen and, you know, all kinds of good design work happens over time. I think there's also the realization that to accommodate all these many different use cases around the world, you need a ton of different projects. You need a lot of different designers that are placed around the world to solve these problems more locally, maybe. Right? So you need kind of a community. So that was kind of the starting points. And then there were initially the like 8 to 10 grants were given or so, and a whole bunch of people have come and gone, and some have moved on to do different things. Like Bosch is now at River, shout out to him. Steven's at Voltage. Eddie's at actually he didn't get Eddie's a great guy. He's at Foundation now, but he actually didn't get a grant. He has been doing this on the side. So all kinds of, oh yeah, Johns has done Bolt Fun now. So there have been all kinds of cool relationships and stories and projects that come out of things. And today I'll leave that to Mo. How about that?
Yeah, sure. I'll take over from there. Today we have the Bitcoin Design Foundation. And I just want to give a shout out to Daniel as well, because he's not here on this call, but he's been one of the, you know, people who was one of the starting members of the Bitcoin design community, and was one of the people who came up with the idea of the Bitcoin design guide as well. But The community, you know, as Christoph mentioned, very grateful for Spiral for, you know, creating this initial ecosystem and the support system to fund people to work in this space. And now we have the Bitcoin Design Foundation, which is serving as a facilitator, really. So the Bitcoin Design Foundation is facilitating, you know, bringing more people into the space to support good design in the ecosystem at large. You know, Christoph, I don't know if you want to take off from there as well.
Yeah, I was going to say we have these three pieces, really. There's the Discord where people just, it's an open forum. You can hang out. There are different channels across different topics, categories. Some are related to projects. Some of our two technologies. There's one for Summer of Bitcoin we started recently because there's some mentoring happening there as well. And that is really just an open forum to bring people together and allow that conversation to happen. Then something also from very early on, that's where you hear about the Bitcoin Design Guide, UI Kit, Icons, UX Research Kit. That's the idea of creating public resources. So as a developer, you know, you never start from scratch. You pull in some frameworks, some libraries, and you build on top of those, right? So designers doesn't really exist that well, right? But the idea is then we have these resources that we work together as a community, continuously improved. And then when you start a project, you know, you have this really great foundation to start with. That's the second part. And the third part, that's where these collaborations come in. Mo is involved in some project. I'm involved in some other projects. There's some overlap. So you have all these different people in the community with various types of involvement, and they are involved in different projects at different times and different capacities. Like you might have a brand designer or a web designer who maybe, like you don't need a web or brand designer, right, for like 2 years, right? They might come in and help with a project at a certain time. You might have someone who really works with a project for a really long time, like Eddie, who I mentioned earlier, who works with the Join Market web UI. So that's kind of the three pillars, the, you know, the community, the public resources, if you will, and then the project collaborations.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah. So yeah, that's a good summary there. And so let's also talk about what most people are getting wrong. I think that might make it interesting for people in terms of, let's say there are, you know, people thinking about building Bitcoin products and apps. What are some common mistakes or common things that people neglect to do from a design perspective?
Mo, would you like to kick that off?
I'm happy to kick that one off. Design is not just about what you see. I think most people think that, you know, have the misconception that design is this flat, you know, static thing that you see on your screen in front of you. But design is so much more. It's interactive. It is an interactive conversation that you're having with the person who's using your Bitcoin wallet. To give a practical thing, you know, Bitcoin, what I think Bitcoin wallets can do a lot better is start to build repertoire and have a conversation with their users, as opposed to just pushing a very specific user experience, you know, down their users' throats, if I could put it that bluntly. Try to have a bit more of a back and forth conversation, just like we are right now, you know, you give and you take. So something that's very intricate that I see within an application when I'm onboarding myself is how much of information is that application taking from me, and how much of feedback am I getting as I'm giving information? So that's the one thing that I'll touch on. And the second thing that I'll touch on is error messages and error states. I think that is highly neglected in the space. When your user is on your Bitcoin wallet and they've made a mistake and they've typed in the numbers incorrectly and your application is not giving good feedback about what they're doing wrong, they're in a position of fear, like, I don't know what's going on, like, help me here. And there, you know, Bitcoin wallets are in a very good position to give them proper feedback about what's going wrong and make them feel safe again, because they then move from a space of, I don't feel safe, I don't know what's going on, to, okay, like, the application gives them feedback, lets them know this is what you're doing wrong, and guide them in the right direction.
Yeah, so, that's really interesting. I think I can relate to that in a way, because let me put it this way. Bitcoin has come from this, let's say, open source, online kind of hardcore community. And it's kind of seen where, you know, in those earlier days, it was seen, you know, there's a famous acronym RTFM, read the effing manual, right? And it's kind of like, oh, you're a noob. you're doing it wrong, RTFM, right? And that's kind of, you know, that was kind of the culture, let's say, that some of the, you know, maybe some of the apps kind of came from, and it was kind of seen like, you know, it's your rite of passage. Learn how to do it correctly, or, you know, go be a hacker man and do the CLI way without even using a UI at all, right? And that's kind of like where maybe, you know, historically it might have come from. And then I think what happens is there's this curse of knowledge idea, right? Because once you've been in for a while and you are very familiar with using these Bitcoin apps and wallets, and you know, it's very familiar to you, and you forget what it's like for a new person when they're coming in. And so then you kind of forget all the things that you know, that you sort of, you treat it like, oh, it's just tacit knowledge. Everybody just kind of already knows this thing, but actually they really, really don't. And so then new people are scared, right? When they open this wallet and it kind of gives them these crazy prompts and they don't know exactly what's going on. And I think to your point, it is about building trust with that user. So as you mentioned, there were two main prongs there. One was around asking questions for your user. So I guess some apps now are starting to do like a questionnaire thing, like, are you a beginner or an intermediate or an advanced user? And then the secondary part, as you mentioned, was around error messages. So let's talk a little bit about some examples. I know, I think off the top of my head, I think BitKit is one example where I think they do ask you some questions as part of the setup for that wallet. Like, oh, what is the size of the Lightning channel you would like? That kind of thing. Are there any other examples, you know, that you're aware of where maybe the wallet actually asks you the questions and you actually answer those questions?
It's very delicate, you know, it's the conversation that happens. It's very much, you can imagine someone onboarding themselves onto a wallet, and it's, you know, you can keep the onboarding process very short, but you can also create a relationship in the beginning. And that's where this conversation comes in, this sort of back and forth. So, for example, if you're onboarding yourself onto a Lightning wallet, you know, you can ask them, like, you know, what is the purpose of using this wallet? Are you going to be sort of sharing your liquidity with other people? Or are you going to be just using it for your own personal sort of low expense things? Get that sort of feedback in the beginning, have a conversation, and then confirm the feedback that the user gives to you. I cannot actually think of a practical example that I've seen in a Lightning wallet, if I can be very honest, of something where I've seen this sort of conversation happening. It's something that I'd like to see more of, you know, in wallets, but I cannot think of a practical situation. I don't know if you can, Christoph. Okay.
One other thing I would point out here as well, I'm curious to get your reactions on it, is when I'm teaching a new person, oftentimes, now, of course, I give them the standard, you know, write down these 12 words, don't show anybody, don't take a picture, don't put it on your cloud, don't put it on your Dropbox or your Google Drive or anything. You know, like, you tell them all these things about being careful with those 12 words. But actually, one of the challenges is impressing on that person how important it is to not lose, you know, those 12 or 24 words. And maybe that is also part of the challenge. And maybe that's where some of the design and UI and UX can help. Potentially.
Yeah, for sure. So we spend a whole bunch of time on that. And so the 12 words, so one thing that we came up with that we talk about in the Bitcoin Design Guide as well is that you actually offer a template to print out, because grabbing a piece of paper by itself, a post-it, that's disposable, right? If you have a nicely printed sheet where, you know, you manually fill in your information and it looks kind of proper and legit, you can fold it up, put it in an envelope, you know, put your mark on it, put it in a safe or so. That already creates a little bit of a ceremony that makes it more important. You put a date on there, you put down which wallet you used. You want to print kind of an empty template, like even if you have an output descriptor or other things, like there's some non-sensitive information you can print out, but anything sensitive should be manually written down. And then you make them put it away. And then the other thing I would say there is the idea of progressive security. So these 12 words are not that important until you put a meaningful amount of money associated with them. So, and that's where a wallet can, if you have a single sig wallet, if you have a Lightning wallet or so, they can tell you, like, you know, the amount of money you have in this wallet is not appropriate to your security level. You should really upgrade here. And that's something we have in the guide as well. So a Lightning wallet could offer you to automatically move something to cold storage automatically, or prompt you to it. A single sig wallet could say, or a single sig hot wallet or whatever could say, you know, you should move to something else. Here are a few options. Please consider this. And it could remind you every 6 months or so. So there's not just a singular moment at the beginning, because at the beginning, those words are not associated with any value. That just kind of happens later over time. And helping people, it's just like Signal reminds you every couple of weeks or so to type in your PIN so you don't forget it. These kind of health checks and security checks, I think, are pretty great. I'd love to see those more implemented more often.
Back to the show in a moment. This show brought to you by mempool.space, the leading Bitcoin and blockchain visualizer. I often check mempool.space when I want to see what the prevailing fee rates are and to keep track on various things in the Bitcoin ecosystem. Mempool.space has various dashboards that you can use. Of course, there is the front page just to see the fee rates, but you can also see the mining tab. You can see there's a lightning tab. There's even a liquid tab. There's just so many things that you can explore about the Bitcoin and blockchain ecosystem, and mempool.space is there constantly upgrading and updating visualizations and ways of understanding what's going on. So if you're interested in this, go to mempool.space, and note they've got an accelerator program, so you can sign up for that at mempool.space/accelerator. When it comes to securing your Bitcoin, CoinKite.com is the place to go. CoinKite is my favorite provider of Bitcoin security hardware. They have the cold card. They have various other devices that you can use to either secure your coins or maybe back up and make sure that you can recover your coins. So with the cold card, the Q, or the tap signer, you can use a security device to keep your keys offline. And this is a really important concept for us in Bitcoin security, because we don't want our private keys touching online connected devices, or at least devices that are always online. It's better to keep them in offline devices and use them to sign Bitcoin transactions. Now, with the cold card, you can use it with various devices or with various pieces of software such as Sparrow Wallet, Spectre Desktop, Electrum, Nunchuck, Keeper, and various others. With the cold card, you can use various security techniques, whether that's single signature, whether that is using a passphrase, whether that's using multi-signature. I like the cold card security model because it has various components that help you by providing a defense in depth approach. So for example, the cold card has firmware checks. It's checking to make sure that the firmware that you're updating it with is correct, and that can help you. There are also anti-phishing words that can help you in the case of an evil maid attack, because if that device has been tampered with, those anti-phishing words will be different. So there's lots of features, and a lot of careful thought has gone into the creation of the cold card and the security model. So that's why I use it as part of various setups of my own, and I recommend it also. So go to get yours at coinkite.com. Use code Livera for a discount on your cold cards. And now back to the show. I think it's also, maybe there's also a life cycle stage here, not just of the users, but also of the developers, right? Because a new wallet or app developer, he might be great at coding, but he's not good at design. And maybe that's where the disconnect is, right? Because maybe, you know, genuinely, it's just, you know, specialization of labor, right? Not everyone is not good at everything. And there are certain tasks that you are good at and you're bad at. And maybe that's just what happens, is that the people who tend to start a wallet, they tend to be more technical, tech-savvy, and maybe not as focused on the UI and the design components of it. So maybe that's just a kind of a life cycle thing. And then as that wallet becomes bigger, more popular, more funded, or it's run by a bigger company, now they can leverage more professionalized design, research, UI resources.
Yeah, exactly. That's totally a growth thing. And that's the same for startups or any other type of company. Even with larger companies, you sometimes hear that they replace their executives or so. The situation's changed. Someone else is needed for a different stage of growth or so. I think that's a normal human group dynamic. And a lot of projects start by someone just being fascinated or wants to build something. BTC paver server, what's the famous tweet that started it? I will put you
right.
out
this
of business.
This is lies. I'll make you obsolete. Yeah.
And, you know, look at BTC Pay Server, what it's grown to today with all these satellite events, and they're doing this work like with Madeira, you know, having all these point of sales. And there's definitely a growth and kind of a maturation that has to happen. And the people at the beginning, they're kind of essential to understand that their role has to change a little bit. And not everyone wants that. Some people are okay just building their own thing. If other people want to use it, that's their problem, right? But and some people, they really invite this community in and are open to adjusting the process, giving over maybe some of the responsibilities to other people. That's a really organic thing. And we see quite a bit of that happened too. I mean, I think Albie started as a hackathon, Lightning hackathon project, and then we helped them come up with the name and the logo and the website, and it was hosted in the Bitcoin Design Slack and now Discord for a long time, and it's just kind of grown into this whole separate thing. Their designer is still very active in the community. So we see these things, and sometimes it happens, and sometimes it doesn't. But yeah, I feel like there's also kind of you can also plateau at a certain point, right? And I think a lot of projects, a lot of wallets have not gotten to the point where I would love to see like this really thorough implementation of contacts and activity and some of these health checks and kind of this intelligent support of users. I'd love to help with that, of course, as well.
I'm gonna throw one more, one more screwdriver into this conversation as well. And we have these community calls in the Bitcoin Design community, and during one of the calls, we also discussed that there's so much of room and freedom in the space at the moment to be very creative with the designs of the wallets that we're bringing forward. That's just coming back to that last question you asked: what do most people get wrong about design at the moment? We have the standard, Bitcoin or Lightning wallet, and at the moment there's a lot of room within that sphere to go a bit out of the box and be very playful and be very creative with what we're designing. And I feel like we're just not quite there yet, which is okay, because then we have this beautiful mountain to climb together, But there's a lot of room to design for a very specific type of persona, and a lot of wallets can really take advantage of that as an opportunity. Like, make that design of that wallet suit that person, And I'm gonna throw something crazy out there, like a skater or something, or a surfer. I don't know, you can really be playful and creative in the design of the wallet. So
Yeah, and I think that's a so the, there's a saying that the product reflects the org chart of your company, right? The point being that companies create certain products because they need to have a business and profit and all of this stuff. Governments create certain types of things, and open source projects can create something unique, right? Because it's a unique way of working together. So we could have like the wildest, craziest Bitcoin wallets and products out there, and sometimes you see that, like the BitAxe group that takes apart ASICs, reinvert what is it, re re-engineers them and like builds their own crazy little home mining devices. I think that's really cool. So yeah, I think there's a very unique design opportunity in open source and Bitcoin that we could tap into a bit more.
Yeah, I see. And so one other area, just while I was picking through the website and having a look, I saw in the Bitcoin design kit there was this usage life cycle, which I thought would be really interesting as well for users. Something called out to me because, okay, so let me just explain what I saw, and I'm curious to hear your reactions on it. So I was looking at this usage life cycle, and I saw, there's unaware, aware, interested, first use, regular use, passionate use. So it's kind of like there's a life cycle there of using different Bitcoin apps and products. And I think probably the counterintuitive thing that came across from here from this to me was, I'm pretty much all day when I'm talking about Bitcoin, I'm talking to other people who are in the regular use or passionate use. I'm barely even talking to people who are in that unaware or aware category. But it's like we're stuck in this little echo chamber or little bubble world because I'm only speaking to the people who are passionate users or regular users, and I'm barely interacting with the people who are unaware or aware, but they actually represent a big percent of, let's say, the app users, things like that. So I thought that was really, really well put and counterintuitive. I'm curious if you have any other insights or anything like that you want to add there.
If I may, because I love that page too. I came across that a long time ago, 2012 or something, that idea first, and I think it's so important. And that was something that I was going to say that people misunderstand. So user experience is like a sequence of events, right? It's like a movie, right? You don't if you hop in, halfway through a movie, it's not going to make sense to you, right? You need the introduction of the characters and the scenery and to see the story develop. And so the all of this starts really the first time you hear about a product, the first time you hear about Sparrow or BitKey or Zeus or Bitcoin Core or whatever it is, like the first time you hear it, and then you might ignore it, but you might hear it again. Then at some point you might be like, you know, let me figure out what that is. Someone tells you about it. You go to the website, you take a look at it. You kind of get a, you form a rough model of what this thing is about and what problems it's meant to solve and how it's built. Maybe you decide against it or for it, and that's kind of the aware stage, right? Ideally, you make it to interested. You still don't exactly know in detail. You don't really care about the detailed features, but you realize, like, I have this problem here in my life, right? This seems like something that will help me. And then you maybe go to the first use. That's where you need to have a further introduction to some of the mechanics of it. And then ideally, you know, you have a good first experience, you get your wallet, maybe you just have an address, and that was kind of everything you wanted. And over time, it kind of develops, you keep coming back to it. I think it's a super sensitive thing. And I think this framework really helps resolve a lot of design discussions. I've heard it so many times in projects where it's like, oh, we need a simple mode, and we need an advanced mode. Right, it's for kind of the one that abstracts it all away and the one that has all the functions. And I think if you look at it from a usage lifecycle mode perspective, is that you don't need that, right? If you guide people step by step through this experience deeper and place like the more complex things, the things that more the regular or the power users need, if you place them a little bit further, if you explain the concepts a little bit earlier, then you can guide people very smoothly into all kinds of complexities. And if you look at like video games, Super Mario, or I don't know, these super complex games out there, like they do a great job with all these little, they teach you the initial mechanics, you learn how, you know, bump against this little block to get the gold coin or bump on the head of the turtle or so. And then very quickly, 10 minutes later, you're doing all kinds of crazy movements and navigating this world very effectively. So I'm a huge, huge fan of this usage lifecycle. And if I may give a little bit of a negative example here, which we're also helping to improve, if you look at bitcoincore.org, or even if the Bitcoin Core page on bitcoin.org, there's no screenshot of what the Bitcoin Qt wallet looks like. There's no list of features. You have no idea really what it does or what problems it's meant to address. And so there are these gaps filling in the kind of aware slash interested stage. So people download the application, open it up. It instantly like starts to know, it starts like syncing blocks, and they're like, and they already, the wallet was already created in the background. They're like, okay, seems cool, but I don't understand at all what's going on. I have no idea what I got myself into. So I'm a huge fan. I'll say that again. Please study this usage lifecycle. Consider it in your design process.
That's a great example with video games, right? As many, especially, you know, young boys, and you know, when I was a boy, I played a lot of games, and yeah, it is true. Like, there's actually a lot of complexity. It's just that the way the game designers set it up is that you learned as you went in through the levels. And so maybe it's a similar thing with, you know, Bitcoin apps, Bitcoin wallets that people have to learn as they go through the different levels of using Bitcoin and Lightning and things like this. So also, let's talk a little bit about how you do what you do. So you mentioned there's three parts, right? You've got the Discord and the community part. You've got the design guide and the UI kit. And then you've got these projects where you go and actually collaborate with some of the different projects, like you mentioned, Bitcoin Core, and I believe Blixt, and a few others out there. Do you want to just talk through what it looks like when you guys go to work with a Bitcoin app? What does that look like?
Christoph and I have worked I've had the pleasure of working with Christoph for a couple of years now on a few projects. We work on Bitcoin Core app together the longest. Full transparency, literally hopped on those calls, was in the Bitcoin community. I was like, hey, my name's Mo, I'm here. I don't know what's going on, and I don't understand half of the words you're talking about, but I want to help and contribute. And now, like a couple of years later, I'm still working on Bitcoin Core app with Christoph. But projects enter into the community very organically. Some of them have been in the community for longer, as I mentioned, like Bitcoin Core app, Christoph mentioned the LB team as well. So they'll help into the community. And I think everything starts off with this initial conversation of understanding the goals of the project, understanding the resources that they have available, understanding the resources that they have available is quite important, because if you're able to provide designs to a team and they're not able to implement the designs, then it's, you know, also not a very good use of anyone's time. So they'll enter into the community. We'll usually kick it off with a call. We'll have a call. We'll ask some questions. We'll sort of prod and ask a few questions, try to build a bit of a framework of who the project is in front of us, what are their needs, and what might be the biggest impact in the design process. And then we'll make a decision in terms of, you know, is there research that's needed here, or is there pure design work needed here? And we'll sort of branch off into one of those two directions. And it's, you know, I mean, it's been such an interesting journey because every single project that we've worked with has been so fun, so dynamic, so ready to turn the whole UX design process on its head. And because that's who we are, we allow them to turn the UX process on its head and do things differently. We welcome that in the community. So I guess it's not a full direct answer to your question, but I guess just to sum it up, we follow definitely some general guidelines in terms of understanding the project, moving forward in the design process, but we also very much allow the team to guide the direction of the project. You know, we're not the experts. Everyone is. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah.
One question on the complexity part. I'm sure there might be developers listening, or maybe they might think, well, the thing I'm working on is really, really complex. And how do you skillfully convey that to the users? And, you know, in fairness, maybe some of these apps are not designed for, let's say, end user, like retail guy using his phone. Maybe they're designed for another developer. Like, so their customer, in a sense, is another developer or some other entrepreneur or builder in the space. And maybe there's like a lot of complexity around, you know, how you configure the thing and use the thing. What do you do when you get to a really complex thing or complex product? How do you deal with that from a design perspective?
Yeah, I would just add that this is a completely public process. Anyone can respond or organize or chip in or just be part of it. And, you know, Mo and I were just two people. There are many other people. They also help out with all of this stuff. And we always try to connect projects with designers and hope, you know, something good happens there. The complexity, we recently had two calls with the 1010-1 finance team.
Right.
Around
I did an episode with recently, yeah.
yeah, exactly. I listened to that one too. And the first call was really just us trying to understand how these synthetic stablecoins work with this, you know, market mechanism and shorting and longing, and, you know, how they're backing them and what happens in different scenarios. And the first call was just an hour. It didn't feel like we made much progress. It was just this back and forth, just to get to dive in and understand it. And then we kind of needed to digest it. And we had a second call then, and that was more focused around specifically how to separate a very simple user experience to more someone who really wants to trade day to day, away from the person who just wants to say, I just want to have a stable dollar or euro value right now. This is my priority. I want to press a button. That's it. I'm going to leave it there for 3 weeks. And it just, I need to come back and it needs to be there. And so the second one was very focused. So I think that's a good model where we do this initial exploration call where the project also learns a little bit how to open up and present their project and engage with the community. And then there's like some online conversation that happens. And then the second call goes into like one specific aspect of, but the joint market web app, that was actually one of the most complex projects that I was followed along with, because it's so counterintuitive with all of these, the coin joins that happen.
Mixed depths and things.
Mixed depths. They came up with these different jelly jar buckets where your funds are distributed. And then the whole yield aspect or earn aspect of it, even the naming of that is kind of tricky with your fidelity bonds and all of that. That was really a very long multi-month project with a lot of iteration. So big shout out to that team for working through that.
Back to the show in a moment. Swan.com is the lead sponsor of this show. Over at Swan.com, you can buy Bitcoin and learn about Bitcoin. So that's using Swan.com, the website, or using Swan Bitcoin, which is an application you can find either on Apple iPhone or on Android phones in the Google Play Store. Now you can sign up really quickly on the app and you can then transfer your dirty fiat into Swan, either using ACH or wire. And then from there, you can either do a lump sum purchase or a smash buy, or you can set up an ongoing recurring savings plan. Now, many people will take an initial lump sum and then set up a recurring purchase plan. That's a really great way to go about it, because then as long as you have a long horizon and you are continually stacking for a longer period, those coins that you accumulate during the bear markets, they often end up being worth a lot more during the bull cycle. And it also helps you deal with the volatility of Bitcoin by regularly stacking over time. Now, Swan makes it easy for you because there's a lot of education, and Swan wants you to self-custody your coins. It is free withdrawals. You have free automated withdrawals to your self-custody. You can put in your Bitcoin address. You can put in a range of Bitcoin addresses and automatically withdraw your coins. Swan makes it easy for you. So go and sign up there over at swan.com/Livera to get $10 of Bitcoin dropped in your account when you start stacking with Swan. And now back to the show with Christoph and Mo.
Yeah. One other thing when it comes to, let's say, you know, retail facing users with their app, I think there's maybe a lot of room for confusion when we've got different layers and different aspects of Lightning. As an example, right, are you doing an on-chain payment? Is it a URI? Like, is it a one QR code that can handle Bitcoin and Lightning? Even in the world of Lightning, there's different types of QRs there. Some people are using like AMP and, you know, other, you know, and then you have things like LNURL and Lightning address. It can all be very confusing for somebody who's not sort of into the weeds, into the detail. And so that user might think, oh, I thought my Lightning wallet could just scan and pay, but actually maybe their Lightning wallet doesn't support this feature and that feature. I'm curious if you have any thoughts, any ideas on, you know, what should be done there around, you know, simplifying that.
That is a very huge task. I think there are multiple levels. One is that we need these ecosystem interoperability efforts, like the Bitcoin QR campaign or the Ren Taproot campaign. Maybe a Bolt 12 campaign, a silent payments campaign, maybe at some point, you know, other ones. So I think that's pretty important. So the technology actually gets closer and we start reducing those gaps, so we don't have to solve them on a UI level in the first place. I would also add in here a multi-language seed phrases, which can be kind of a helpful thing. There are always these chicken and egg problems in there as well. But yeah, so it depends on what product you're designing, but ideally it's good to, and it takes a lot of craft to kind of not surface these things all the time. So Eric, who works on Enuts, the cashew wallet, they also had the same question. How do we hide all the different mints? How do we allow you to select the mints at just the right time when it's important, and not show it to you in the interface all the time? But you know, a user has different relationships to different mints. Some they trust more, some they trust less. So the ones that they trust more, they want to have more funds in them than the other ones. There are all kinds of complexities. It's very intricate to work through that. But I think it helps if you're trying to do a project, a wallet that does everything, then you need to kind of show everything, right? If you have a very specific one, then you can figure out which ones you want to hide and automate. It's just like Moon decided they want to have this offline backup. They want to have, you know, they want to have everything on chain. So they moved everything there. Phoenix maybe does the opposite, right? They have clear directions in their products, and that allows them to hide certain things. But yeah, we have a lot more of that coming up with eCash, BitVM, Arc. We have a lot of work to do there. I'm excited also to dig into that one.
Yeah. One other question I have is, how do you deal with competing standards, right? Because this is another one, right? Like whether it's seed backup standards or different, you know, different techniques, different technologies. How do we deal with that from a design perspective?
I think we have to solve that as a community. I mean, as a single designer, you know, you can chip in, you can put your best forward, you can, and I think, so here's another thing that I think about, these four time horizons. There's like the dreaming, blue sky in the future, hyper-Bitcoinization, whatever. Then there's kind of the far future where we have, let's say, Covenants and Arc, BitVM. We don't, like, it's something's going to happen. It sounds very promising, but don't quite know how it's going to work out. But we can kind of design scenarios. We can make prototypes. We think about the use cases. We kind of figure things out. Then we have the kind of near-term stuff, like silent payments, Bolt 12, where it's going to happen. It's kind of alpha. No wallet really supports it. But we want that to happen. We can design. We can figure out best practices. We can figure out how we want this to work on an ecosystem level. So, and then we kind of have the right now, like the problems that projects have right now, that wallets have right now, that just needs to be fixed. And so I think if we can be forward looking with our design work, then I think we can help resolve some of these standard issues. I mean, you have the BIP47 that's being, Blue Wallet's going to implement BIP47, but you also have silent payments happening right now. That's, you know, one of these potential conflicts there, trying to do the same thing slightly differently. So that one, I think it's a little bit too late, maybe. I don't know about that one. I think the market kind of has to sort that out. I do think it helps if there are champions for certain standards that go around, convince everyone, have really a great website that maybe explains it all. They go around, they campaign for it, have those conversations, get those doubts out of the way, or maybe adjust the protocol and come back and make improvements or so. But yeah, as designers, I think if you have two competing standards right now, we're kind of in the middle of all of this. We can help lay out different scenarios, and then just, I think the hive minds, the builder community together needs to find a way forward. Yeah, I guess covenants, right? We'll see. That's kind of one of these stalemates there. I'm curious to see how that one pans out.
Yeah. Just Mo, anything to add there?
Yeah. Just to tail end off what Christoph says as well, is I think it's fun. You know, we were having this conversation because we worked very closely together. So every now and then we have a call. And during this call, I said, it's fun to have all these sort of cool technologies, which I use the word for the standards. I said, it's fun to have all of these cool technologies that we have access to. And that's fun and cool. But the bottom line is which technology is specifically solving a very specific problem for one person? That's what I'm interested in. Like, if that cool technology is solving that problem for that one person, then it should be used there. And the only person who can give you that answer is the user themselves by actually speaking to people. You know, I'm a big advocate for UX research. So actually speaking to people and asking them and doing a little bit of fact finding before deciding which technology is suitable to them, instead of the other approach, which is we have access to this cool technology. Let's just build cool things and put it in front of people and think people are going to use it. But it's very much about ask yourself the question, what problem is your cool technology solving in people's lives? Because people use things because it solves problems in their life.
Yeah, you know. Right. I totally get what you're saying, because there are times where I see this in online discussion where people just kind of have this bright, shiny thing syndrome, and they sort of say, oh, look at this cool thing I can build. But it hasn't been validated in terms of what the actual user really actually wants. And so then sometimes you get this disconnect between what the builders and developers are talking about and what actual real world users are using. Now, of course, to be fair, there is the infamous, and I'm sure you heard this quite a million times, the kind of, what's it, the Henry Ford, you know, if I asked what the customers wanted, I would have given them a faster horse, and therefore that's why sometimes, let's say, a strong-willed builder, entrepreneur, developer just has to come out and make it and put it out there. But then there's kind of the counterpoint of sometimes people just build things and it doesn't actually get used. So I guess that's the dichotomy there, right?
Yeah, Bitcoin was also not really, my impression was that at the time, a lot of the cypherpunks, they were like, oh no, not another attempt of it. It's not going to work out anyways, right? So even the believers were not really initially convinced, and it took time for this to mature. So sometimes technology is also like this fragile little plant that kind of has to grow and you know, find its way in the world and even be protected. It sounds like Satoshi was very protective, like don't hoard too much, you know, be careful with the network and whatnot. So I think you need just a lot of different experimentation, and sometimes it's really surprising. I try to keep a very open mind about, because sometimes these things really come out of an angle that you just didn't expect. And some of the technology and the follow-on effects of how people use it and the dynamics that come out from that are really impossible to predict.
I see. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the Bitcoin research. You were touching on this, Mo, around the UX research, asking the user what they want, asking them how they're using it. So I can just see from the website, bitcoinresearch.xyz, you've got there some questions there, things like, are we building the right thing? How do we set up a long-term research process? How do we get buy-in from the rest of the team? What do we do with user feedback, right? Because maybe it just kind of, they're getting feedback, but actually it's just going into some mailbox that nobody reads and we're not using it. So can you just talk to us a little bit about Bitcoin research and, you know, what are people missing there? What are some common mistakes on the Bitcoin research front?
I'm going to keep it as simple as possible. I've been working in the space as an evangelist for research for a while now, connecting with so many different open source projects, and just do it, you know? I mean, just start somewhere, start small, even if it's going to be a 5-minute conversation with a potential user before you're about to kick off your project. That 5 minutes will make such a big difference in not only giving you a little bit of data to shape the direction of your project. You know, I think most people have a misconception that research is something that takes super long, or they need to stop their whole project for 3 months. And that is a misconception, because we can do things as we'd like to do things. You know, you can communicate with a project that you're with, be very open and honest. Do you want to spend an hour on research? Sure, then we'll spend an hour. Like, do you want to spend 2 months on it? Sure, we'll spend 2 months. But I think the biggest thing for me is for builders of their wallets to understand the jobs to be done. So like the jobs that their application needs to do to serve that problem of that one person, that user. Understand the jobs that your application needs to do to serve your user, to serve that one person who you're looking to serve. And, you know, we built the UX Research Toolkit, and I say we because Christoph helped to build it, Art helped to build it, Jan helped to build it, Jakob also helped to build it. It was built by the community, that website. It was not built by a single person. And the minds that went into building that, they each person worked in a very different sort of market, and they thought, what UX research processes and methodologies have helped us to understand our users? So the decisions made in the toolkit was made by a lot of people, and it was intentionally kept very simple for a reason, is that we just wanted people to use it. Just go in there, do a little bit of research, and just, you know, understand your users.
Yeah. One other point here, which I'm sure a lot of listeners will be thinking and considering, and I'm sure you've thought about this, is obviously a lot of Bitcoiners, though not everyone, tend to be privacy and security focused, right? And so sometimes, and I'm sure you know where I'm going with this, right? Some projects almost like to say, we don't even know how many people are using our software. And therefore, that makes it difficult because they don't want to put in tracking software or trackers into their applications. And so then how do you balance that with actually having someone who you can reach out to for research purposes to make sure you're actually getting a good sample of users of your app or product?
I love this question, Steve. This is such a good question. So when I entered into the Bitcoin space and I learned like a few years ago, I was like, there's no tracking here? Like, what? My brain had to do a double take. I was like, but how are you collecting data? How are you doing things? No, we don't do that. Okay. Well, there's a go around, you know, there always has to be ways to get around this. So qualitative research, meaning actually having calls with the users of the application that you're building, is something that helps to collect information. So this is such a sticky topic because even, you know, getting on that call with someone, you're not going to test out their Bitcoin wallet with them. Of course not, because that's their Bitcoin wallet. So you would be testing out a pre-built wallet or a wallet that you would ask them to log into that already is being used for testing purposes, or a prototype. In that way, you're protecting their privacy because you're not testing it on their wallet themselves. And then you're also collecting information. You only need to have 5 30-minute conversations, and that will reveal most of the biggest friction points in your application. It's literally that simple. You know, you can go down all the complex, you're signing with me. it's that simple. Just 5 30-minute conversations will reveal the biggest friction points in your application that you're building. It's that simple. And then something else that I'm now delving into as a UX researcher is processing user data and making it publicly available, because that's something that we're very passionate about in the open source space, is making all of the data publicly available. So something that I'm very sensitive to is removing any data in any information that I'm making publicly available to protect that person's privacy. Very important.
Yeah, interesting. Because this is something we see on even on social media. There are different app developers who sort of flex, oh, see, look, we have no trackers. And they might even use that as a competitive point to sort of say, oh, look, my competitor, he's tracking you. I won't track you. Come to me, etc. And so, you know, that's just a normal, obviously, different projects will try to compete, obviously, to, you know, get users. And, you know, so be it. But I guess that's a dynamic that's maybe a little more unique to the, let's say, Bitcoin and privacy-focused online people. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, the process of somebody reaching out, right? Let's say somebody's listening now. They are a builder, a developer, or they are an entrepreneur, and they're curious about how they can get involved. What are the main ways for them to reach out or find out more? What's the process look like?
I mean, someone who's a builder who's around, they can simply hop into Discord and say hi and just share what they're talking about. The best things just start with an initial conversation, sharing a little bit about what you're doing, why you're doing it, maybe share some links. If you have a certain design problem, you can contact Mo or I or even in Discord. So just to say, I'd like to have a design review. We have a design review channel, and then we'll just schedule one. Could be in 2 weeks, 5 weeks, whenever. And then we'll try to get a group of people together and just talk about share your project. We can talk about it. If you're looking for a designer, we also have a newsletter where we just put in opportunities, and we have an opportunities channel. We also try to tweet about it and post it on Nostra account, just to give a little bit visibility to projects and what they're kind of looking for at the moment. But yeah, it's as simple as just starting a conversation. And if someone's looking to contribute, we have this join page on the website, /join, bitcoin.design/join. And that's, we just redid that one to turn it into like this adventure, like this series of milestones. So if you're brand new to the space, there's some tips for what you can do, introduce yourself. If you're super advanced, you know, it has information about how to join and contribute to design projects. So I think that page should also be hopefully pretty good. And if it's not good, let us know. Then we can improve it together.
Fantastic. Okay, Mo, any final comment from yourself?
And also an open invitation to anyone listening to this, you know, this is an invitation to help us build the ecosystem and increase the amount of designers working in the Bitcoin space. So, you know, the Bitcoin Design Foundation is there as a facilitator. So one of the things that we do is we support new designers. We encourage new designers to research and work on new technology in the space. So that would be Bitcoin. Let me just look at the website quickly. BitcoinDesignFoundation.org. And one of the other things that I'd like to share is an open invitation for people to sponsor the Bitcoin Design Foundation, because with your sponsorship, we can help bring more good design into the ecosystem. So by helping the foundation, we get to help more people and fund more people in the space. And we really want to see more of that.
Great. Well, I'll put the links in the show notes. But yeah, as you said, BitcoinDesignFoundation.org and Bitcoin.design are the two main links. Christoph and Mo, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having
us
here.
Finally, I hope you enjoyed that show. Maybe something a little bit different, but hopefully something valuable for you. If you found the show interesting, make sure to share it out there, press like, and let people know about it. You can find me at stefanlevera.com. Thanks, and I'll see you in the Citadels.